from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, celebrity chef Jacques Pepin has been cooking for almost 60 years. He has published 27 cookbooks and has won a Daytime Emmy, numerous James Beard Awards, and two of France's highest honors. He'll join us in studio to discuss food, his newest cookbook, and his KQED-produced PBS series, Essential Pepin. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. I am, and I have been, and always will be a cook. My culinary identity defines me. So says master chef and PBS culinary star Jacques Pepin, who joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, author of 27 cookbooks. His newest, which includes a DVD, is Essential Pepin, more than 700 all-time favorites from my life in food. His KQED-produced national cooking series, Essential Pepin, will be aired on KQED television. Award-winning chef Jacques Pepin joins us for this Forum Hour. So good to have you back here. Welcome.
I'm delighted to be back. Thank you so much.
It's coming home for you to KQED in many ways, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, I've been doing show here for 25 years. Actually, we did like 12 series altogether of 26 shows. So it's, yes, many, many shows and many, many friends and many, many meals, many, many glasses of wine.
And we've done many shows together. In fact, I was remembering an event we did together with Julia Child at the Mark Hopkins. Suddenly, I was wondering how this affected you. Did seeing Meryl Streep do Julia Child affect your...
I tell you, I was blown out because... When they told me, I say, you know, you cannot do Julia without doing your voice. And if you do your voice, if you do her voice, then it's going to be a cliche. Like 5 minutes into the movie, I totally forgot about it. And Meryl Streep looks taller than Julia. I don't know how she did it, too. She was really good.
It was extraordinary. I mean, how much he became Julia Child. It was also, a lot of people don't know, when they know what they know about your background, they know the story about you coming over here and working for Howard Johnson and having the offer to work for John F. Kennedy, but they don't know that you were actually a cook for de Gaulle. And I was reading about the diet that you used to give, just a kind of daily, you have a consomme, a roasted leg of lamb, au gratin potato, a salad, and maybe custard dessert. But Madame de Gaulle said, don't make the meat too rare because it's not good for the president's blood.
Yes. Well, you know, the world was different. I mean, when I left there, Madame de Gaulle called me in their quarter, in their apartment there, and the president wanted to say goodbye to me, and she, and he gave me a big cigar. He said, smoke that to my health. So, you know what I mean? It was another world.
Well, this it was another world, the world you grew up in, too. I'm always mindful of the fact that you had kind of your earliest and in some ways maybe best training through the privation of what your mother had to do in terms of thriftiness.
Absolutely, yes. I'm very miserly in the kitchen, probably thanks to my mother, and also in the style of French cooking, Chinese or any other. I mean, we probably are the only country in the world to waste food the way we do, and... although it's changing, but certainly during the war when I was a child, there was no food to be wasted.
But you learned to move away from French cuisine, as I said, with Howard Johnson's, of all things, and also Craig Claiborne's place in the East Hamptons back in the 60s. You
know? Absolutely, yes. I mean, someone is coming out with a book on Craig, which I just read the manuscript, and realized he was maybe the most important influence in America, in my professional life, at some way. Not an influence of doing something specifically, but a style of life to who he was and those days we spent in East Hampton and cooking together and so forth. Craig was extraordinary. Unfortunately, a lot of students of cooking and or food writing don't really remember who he was, but he was very important.
And this is an important book, this newest one, because these are all-time favorites. These are take you through sort of all your incarnations, young cook, mature cook, older
true,
cook.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I may represent the quintessential French chef for many people, but you open the book at the first soup, you see a black bean soup with banana. Oh, well, my wife being born in New York City from a Puerto Rican mother and a Cuban father, and next you'll have a ceviche, and then you'll have a fried chicken or something else. So it is a compilation of food that I've loved the last half a century that I've been in America, and I don't try, in a sense, to be French. And by the same token, I don't try not to be French. I don't really think in those terms too much. I cook what I like, and we cook together. And my point is usually to simplify. I mean, I'm maybe very Cartesian this way. And even recipe that I have seen here, that I done recently in show that I've done on KQED, I redone them for this, and I simplify again, simplify. There is always that kind of a streaming down or a better way of doing it, and so forth.
That's also took you into, I think last time we talked, you had done that book on fast food recipes.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, that the two, fast food my way that I did, and actually what I did there, I used the supermarket as a prep cook. What you do in a restaurant, someone comes before you and bone out the chicken, bone out the fish, slice the mushroom, wash the spinach, chop the shallot, so that by the time you come, you're at the stove, you grab a fillet of salt, someone order, you have put a tablespoon of chopped shallot, which is there, some sliced mushroom, a bit of white wine, boil it 1 minute, you finish it up. You can do that dish with fresh ingredients within 3-4 minutes because everything is ready. So there I use the supermarket as a prep cook. I can get boneless, skinless breast of chicken. I use a non-stick pan. I can get pre-sliced mushroom, washed spinach, and so forth. So that was the premise of doing when I did the fast food my way, still doing very fresh and good food, but with a minimal amount of effort and time.
Talking with Jacques Pepin, his newest book, which has a DVD in it, is called Essential Pepin, more than 700 all-time favorites from my life in food. And in the introduction, he says, yet as I look back on my gustatory voyage, I find continuity in my cooking and recipes, a desire to simplify techniques and methods, a striving for simplicity, a search for the best ingredients, and an emphasis on taste rather than presentation or originality.
It's true. And maybe the most important part of the book may be the DVD. I have a DVD of 3 hours. Crammed with technique from sharpening a knife to chopping an onion to boning out a chicken or making an omelette. And they are not even related directly to recipe in the book. They are more a whole apprenticeship, if you want, in itself. You can use those techniques with whatever book you have in your library.
And well, we'll give some recipes, and of course we'll get our listeners involved in this. But I don't know if we've ever talked about the new food movement with you, a lot of new food movements, but farmers market and even some people thinking about going back to raw food or just going back to simplicity. For example, I know that recently you've said some things about the foie gras ban here in California and you find it kind of foolish and everything. But what about all of this necessity to have everything organic and have everything, going back to simplicity, to even things like raw food?
No, it's great. I mean, I always say that my mother, my father, I mean, that was 60 years ago, we're organic farmer. Of course, the word organic did not exist. But since chemical fertilizer did not exist either, and fungicide, insecticide, pesticide did not exist either, so everyone was an organic farmer. You went to the farm or one place and get some cow or some chicken manure and went to do the garden. So it's not that we don't know how to do it. For me, it's not really something new. I've had a garden all my life, basically, and now in Connecticut, and I don't do much, but still a few tomatoes and herbs and stuff, and I never use anything with some, manure that I get in one place or another. So, the fact that even in a small town like where I live in Connecticut, I mean, on summer you have a market on Friday afternoon, but it can be kind of going to the extreme, as we often do here, going to I have been to restaurants where they practically come to the table and introduce you the carrot and say that carrot is named Eva and she was born on the 10th of what? I say, come on, give me a break. Give me the carrot.
Give me the carrot. Well, I remember, in fact, that discussion that we had with Julia, she was a big advocate of eating meat and made no bones about it, so to speak.
Sure, absolutely.
And yet there is a kind of notion now. We did a whole program with some vegan chefs, and they make the case that, you know, you really need to eat just vegan food. And you say what to them?
Yeah, no, absolutely not, no. I mean, you have to eat, whatever I ate, those dishes which are essential and very visceral to me of taste of my youth are will be with me until I died, and I'm not going to change. The point is that Julia had a very open mind this way because she wasn't against, large farm and production and different type of thing. She said, you cannot cut out everything. There is a lot of people to feed in the world, and you have to look at each of those things individually, and some are no good, but some are good. I mean, we've done progress, I mean, in the last half a century or more to feed people in different parts of the world, you know. So it's nice to be in your corner and only wanted to have that salad or this from that farmer, this, that too. But, well, you have to enjoy it first.
Let's talk about some of your recipes in here, like Caesar salad with no raw egg yolk. And you, I know, are a great lover of eggs. You once said that you could stay on an island if you had, you know, access to eggs and wine, you'd be fine living on an island.
True.
But here's blue cheese for Parmesan in a Caesar recipe.
Well, you know what? I don't remember that recipe. If you ask me a recipe like this, after I have to look at it and say, oh, gee, why did I do that? Maybe next time I do it differently. I probably did 4 or 5 different versions. I think this one is my wife. I have anchovy fillet in there, right?
You do,
yeah. Anchovy fillet, too. My wife loves to do it this way. It's very good. Julia didn't approve that recipe. She did another one.
I just found some of these are actually pretty imaginative. Like you have a linguine with clam sauce, but it's a vegetable medley in the white sauce.
Yes, that we do very often at home. And again, it's interesting, you know, my daughter and my granddaughter now I have with 8 years old, and my daughter, I know when she was small, she would have like spaghetti and clam sauce that we do. I have farmer and fisherman that I know in Connecticut, and I get fresh clam and I get a lot of stuff, sometimes pick them up myself. Claudine would say, no, I want mom to do the spaghetti and clam sauce. That's the best one was her mother. Other stuff was my mother that she liked best, you know. And other stuff was me, you know, and that's what happened when you have a child. You remember those smell and those tastes, and that's what she does with her daughter now.
Claudine does a lot of cooking on her own, doesn't she?
Yeah,
I mean,
yes.
No television in her house, just when they get ready for meals, they get ready for meals.
That's it. No television in the kitchen. Or she was with me in Pebble Beach, actually. We cooked together. And my granddaughter, out of that book, as you know, we've done 26 shows here at KQED called Essential Pepin as well, and that started in October, I believe. And Claudine was on a couple of shows, and my granddaughter was in a couple of shows, and she had a bowl doing chocolate, and that was terrific.
Talk about some of these recipes, though. Like there's one for haddock and rice paper with shallots and soy sauce.
Uh-huh, yes. Well, you know, throughout the year, this I thought was a good idea. My wife does a fair amount of oriental food, from Korean to Vietnamese, and so we had those rice paper there. And sometime, you know, I had a nice piece of, I think it was cod. I put it on haddock. I put it right on top of it with a few leaves of tarragon, and fold it, make a package, and saute so it make a crust on the outside. The fish cook to that crust done with the rice paper on the outside. And it's nice, you know, a bit different.
Well, there have been some of these recipes that have gotten a lot of attention, like onion puree.
Yeah, well, onion puree, we use onion puree as a base for many other, like, for example, with rice, we do an onion puree with rice, which is called a soubise. So that is, you do a lot of onion that you cook, and then you put rice, a little bit of rice at the end. Eventually, the rice is used as a binder to do a puree. And that's really good with a roast of veal or something like this. Yeah.
And what about something like these little corn fritters for a first course?
Corn fritter? I mean, you may be surprised. You know, I am from one part of France where we ate corn when we were a kid, because from Bourg-en-Bresse, next to Lyon, known for the chicken of Bresse, B-R-E-S-S-E, which is... And so many chicken there, and of course free range, so a great deal of corn to feed the chicken. So as kid, we used to eat corn. There is different type of soup that we do with corn, which is not that common in France, because most of other place in France, they only give it to the animal, but we did. So, but those corn fritters I learned after I came to America, so I have many of those which are real American recipe that I learned or transformed or adapt here.
As many American recipes here as French. It's about even.
Probably more.
More, yeah.
More, because even the... See, what happened is that when I started to do that book, which wasn't even my idea, I started with like 2,500 recipes and books which were out of print and so forth. And I could have done, like I think the New York Times did last year, a book of the New York Times recipe, which they left the way it was from 20, 30 years ago, just to show a moment in time, I suppose. And that was my dilemma here. I said, do I leave it this way, or do I change it so that I can use it more? And I decided the second option, so it ended up being more work than doing a book. Because, I mean, we don't cook vegetable in the same way that we used to, much less time of cooking to cook fish, to cook vegetable, a different way of doing it. Much less butter, certainly, different type of fat, more olive oil, too. So this is the thing that I adapted, you know.
Well, there's so much in this new book and in the DVD, because you cover soups, salads, eggs and cheese, pasta, rice, grains and potatoes, bread, sandwiches, pizza, shellfish and fish, poultry and game, meat and so forth and so on. Are there any well, I'm wondering about any particular recipes which through the years have proven to be, well, just in terms of the range of palates that, of people celebrating and loving that rise to the top. I mean, the Pepin real showpiece recipes.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. We'll go back to a roast chicken or something like this, you know, or a turkey. I mean, I did a recipe a few days ago on a demonstration here, which is the chicken in vinegar I have in there. And I must not have done that for 20 years. And Claudine was with me doing the demonstration in Pebble Beach. And she said, you know, I tried the recipe at home first. I said, how did it come? She said, came out terrific. We did a puree of turnips and potato mixed together with garlic in it, and that chicken in vinegar and some apple fritter. It was a little menu. I love the chicken in vinegar, and I hadn't done it for 20 years. I said, gee, I'm going to go back home and do it.
This is pretty easy to make.
Yes.
We've also got a recipe for banana tart with guava glaze.
Yes,
that's been getting some attention, yeah.
Well, you know, guava is, again, something that my wife loves, because her Puerto Rican mother gave her guava, little cube of guava with cream cheese on top, and I put a piece of mint, or I change it a little bit. So I feel that, you know, try to bring things together. I'm dealing with oriental, with fruit like banana or, you know, from a hot country. So guava goes with it. I mean, it's part. It's kind of symbiotic. So instead of glazing the top with an apricot glaze to guava glaze, I say would go well with it.
And I think your wife and you have, and Claudine all have different tastes to a great degree, or to...
Yes, certainly. I mean, and the tastes change. I mean, it's always... speculative to know, but certainly, you know, my palate has changed through the year. Your metabolism changed. You get older. You feel like eating things that you eat you didn't before, and vice versa. Things that I used to love, I love less as you get older. I think it happened to everybody.
I remarked to Jacques when he came in, he still has his vitality, but different hips and a different knee.
right.
It's a different incarnation. I'm going to open the phone lines. I know there are many of you who are great appreciators of really one of our great master chefs and may want to talk to him about recipes and talk to him about food, and this is an opportunity to speak to Jacques Pepin. So feel free to join us. Our toll-free number is available to you, and you can call us now at 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your phone calls, and the toll-free number to call is 866-733-6786. You can also email any questions or comments you have. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. And again, we welcome your involvement in the program, and a good opportunity for you to catch some great recipes from one of the greatest master chefs of them all. Remember the last time you were here, I think it was with... No, it was a couple times ago. You were here with the head of the, and you're still with the French Institute.
At the French Culinary Institute. Yeah. In fact, Thursday I'm going. We have a school in California now, right down the valley near San Jose.
But the woman who was in charge then, I don't know if she still is.
Yes, Dorothy Kahn.
Yes, oh, yeah, right. Okay. Yes. She said, it's like walking with a rock star, you know.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But everybody really. Does know you. I mean, there certainly...
No, we all live in mini world, you know, so in the mini world of cooking, hopefully some people know me, but you transcend that world, you go in the world of, I don't know, medicine or architecture, but say, wow, who is this?
Well, but what people may not know about you is that you have transcended that world. In fact, you wrote about... We've both written about Albert Camus.
Yes, Camus, Sartre. I mean, the existentialist, well, that was big in the 50s. I mean, certainly for me in Paris. Yeah.
But also here in the States, didn't you study philosophy?
Yes, I did at Columbia.
Did it help in your cooking?
It did. I know when Claudine went to college, she didn't know what to major in. I said, well, study philosophy. It opened your mind. Just it opened your mind, it may, you can look at things in different way, you know, with more objectivity and so forth. So it's a good thing to study. It will help you in anything that you do.
Let's bring some of our callers in. Aaron, you're first up. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning. Hi, Doc. I just want to say first that I'm a huge fan.
Thank you.
You've been an inspiration to me. I want to say for like 20 years now. I think I was watching you on KQED about 20 years ago. So, you know, and thank you very much
for
your contribution to the richness of my life. My question is about ratatouille. And you have a couple of different recipes in your new cookbook.
Uh-huh.
And I was first introduced to ratatouille about a year ago when I bought Julia's first cookbook, The Art of French Cooking.
Yes.
And... The technique that she uses in that cookbook is about layers of thinly sliced eggplant and zucchini, pre-salted, and then she cooks it on a stovetop in a frying pan. And then I've also seen other recipes that put it in the oven, also in layers with, you know, peppers and onions and parsley.
Yes.
And then both of your recipes are on the stovetop in a big saucepan, just kind of like, cooked down for a long time. What is your favorite recipe? Which one is the most authentic? What, you know, is the best route for me to go with making ratatouille?
Well, it depends how much time. There is always a bit of a trade-off that you want. Certainly when I worked in Paris, we would cook all of those vegetables individually. You know, the zucchini on one skillet, the onion in a skillet, you know, the eggplant in another skillet, the green pepper in another skillet, and eventually put it together and so forth. So it was multi-layered, probably more in the style that Julia did. It's a great deal of work, I mean, much more work, and for me, I think I did it in a much simpler way. Start with one vegetable, which I feel cooked a little longer, add the second one, the third one. Eventually, I have all together in the same pot, and the difference at the end is not that great, for the trade-off in time and so forth. What's more important is to have very good vegetable, I mean, fresh, and you can vary your vegetable. If you do a caponata, which is Italian there, then you will have addition of capers, you will have addition of vinegar and sugar in it to give a certain sweetness to it. And it's a variation on, all around the Mediterranean basin, you're going to find basically the same type of stew with different names, whether it's in Italy, in France, in Greece, in Portugal, you know, or Spain, because that's what grows there, you know. And for me, cooking is always a reflection of climatic condition. I mean, if you have those things growing there, that's what you will find out.
Our guest is Jacques Pepin, celebrity chef, cookbook author, television host. Essential Pepin is currently airing, actually, on KQED-TV. He's also winner of numerous awards, Daytime Emmy, numerous James Beard Awards, and two of France's highest honors, and his new book is Essential Pepin. And when we return, we'll hear more from you. Again, you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. This is KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Jacques Pepin, a celebrity chef who's been cooking for almost 60 years. He's published 27 cookbooks and has won a Daytime Emmy, numerous James Beard Awards, and two of France's highest honors. And his newest cookbook and his KQED-produced PB series called Essential Pepin. And we'll go to more of your calls, and we'll bring Lisa on. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Chef Pepin. It's an honor to speak to you. Hi.
How are you?
Good. I've been watching you since I'm 40 years old. I've been watching you since you probably started on KQED when I was, you know, in my early teens or before that. And yes. I'm wondering if you realize how much of an influence you've had on America's home chefs.
Well, no. What I know is that I did one of my first book was La Technique, which was an illustrated manual of cooking technique, and this is still, in print now because the technique don't really change, just as I did with that DVD. And people used to say, "Gee, I love your book. Can you sign it?" And a number of years came back and say, "You know, my mother really liked that book. Could you sign it for her?" And now people say, "You know, my grandmother is crazy about you. Could you sign that book?" Yes, time have moved on and all that, but it's always. You know, people feel comfortable, I suppose, with a cook. I mean, there is no political implication in what we do, or maybe racial or religious or anything like this. And people can feel comfortable about cooking, about talking about food and so forth. That's maybe the only thing which is politically correct that we can talk about. I'm glad that you have looked at my show for a long time. And if I change a little bit, you're cooking, then it's gratifying for me.
Yeah, thank you, Lisa. I remember once you said to me that, I said, well, all that preparation, all that work, because cooking can be work, hard work. What stays in it for you? And you said, the memory for me and the memory for the person who ate the food.
Sure, yeah. That's true, you know. And the memory, interestingly enough, is rarely from the greatest restaurant in the world and highly decorated food, something that you may go and say, wow. That's fantastic. No, usually that's going to be some dishes you had with very close people of your family. I mean, friends and all that, and those tastes, or with your kid and all that. That's the taste which remains something very visceral. I mean, more than restaurant food.
What do you think of the star system? Especially when you look back just a year ago and one of the great chefs of France committed suicide because he didn't get a star. I mean, is it that oppressive or is it a good system or what do you thought?
Well, it's the only system that I can think of. I mean, certainly Craig Claiborne we discussed before and it's going to be the 50th anniversary soon of when he started at the New York Times. Started the system of a 3-4-star rating. He's the one who, in a sense, created the culinary or gastronomic criticism, you know, in America. And but Craig, I think, was very good because his criticism was always kind of positive. You could always get something out of it. If it's just to criticize, it's very easy to go to a restaurant and tell you what's wrong and this and that. Now, the star system in France, and we have now, I think, 2 in San Francisco and 4 in New York, 3-star, which is absolutely amazing, on the Michelin Guide. Remember, there is only 23 stars in France and about 70 or so 2-star and about 400 and something 1-star. So about 500-600 star restaurants in France out of 134,000 restaurants in France. And now in America, we have almost as many from the star system of the Michelin and in San Francisco, certainly. So it's kind of amazing, but it's a type of cuisine that the mistake is people will go to France or somewhere else and have dinner in 3-4 3-star restaurant in 1 week. You don't do that. It's a very special experience. There is a great deal of anticipation. So I have people in my family have never been in a 3-star restaurant, and it's fine. You can live without it. But the point is that when you do, it's a special experience, and you should enjoy it, and it should be extraordinary.
You're talking about technique. Here's a listener named Andrew. Says, I've been cooking for the past 10 years. It's not an easy job. Papin has been and continues to be a great inspiration to me. I would like to hear his opinion on modern precise cooking and the application of technology in the kitchen. What does Jacques Pepin, the guy who wrote the book on technique, think of so-called technique-driven food that has been shaping the new school of cooking?
It's true, it's different. You know, you have, for me, technique is very important. And technique is really a repetition, endless repetition of a certain movement, whether you use a knife or whatever, so that it becomes so ingrained, so part of yourself, that now you can afford to forget it because it will be there forever. So you can think in terms of texture, in terms of color and so forth, and your hand automatically are moving. Now, as you say, in modern technology now, there is all type of cuisine, certainly molecular cooking, which has been very well known with the Ferran Adrián in Spain, a lot of the Spanish too, and certainly in New York. A few and different part of the country are doing that, using different type of gel, using... often, you know, it's a type of cuisine which... a cuisine of a surprise that you, you know, the idea is to stun someone, say, what the heck is this, you know? And then you eat it and it's liquid inside and you can't figure out what it is. But it's great. I mean, it's a little bit like if you know Jean-Paul Gaultier, which is one of the great French designer, and when you see the you know, the model walking down the aisle and with the outfit that they have, you say, my God, who is going to wear those things, you know? And but somehow it does trickle down to the prêt-à-porter after a few years and to a certain extent. The same idea with molecular cooking, the same idea it was with Nouvelle Cuisine in the 70s, you know? I mean, I've never served before when I work at the Pavillon in New York. When I was in France, even a small restaurant like my mother was very, very inexpensive. Nothing ever was served on a plate. Even at home, she would do a roast, put it in the center of the table, and we had the plate outside and we help ourselves. Nothing was ever served on a plate and given to people. That's what started with Nouvelle Cuisine in the 70s, and now you don't even think of any other way of serving
everything
on plate.
There was so much emphasis in Nouvelle Cuisine in the beginning on the look, on the appearance.
Absolutely,
again, which,
yes.
And for you, it's so much more about taste.
It is. I mean, you know, it's like in a painting. If it's only a question of embellishment and all that, then it doesn't go to the core of the painting, and it doesn't go to the core of the dish. If it's only decorating the dish in one thing or another, especially at the expense of food. Food should be served hot most of the time, except, of course, for dessert. And so if it happened to look great, and it's fine with me, but not at the expense of the taste. I mean, look at you know, Indian cooking or Chinese cooking, certainly. I mean, the emphasis on decoration is pretty minimal. The food goes there, and it has a certain look on itself, which is a natural look and which is great.
Listener named Matthew says, I'd like to know what his favorite chef's knife and favorite dish are.
My favorite chef's knife is the sharp one, that's for sure. And I'm not even being facetious, you know. It is true, otherwise it's kind of useless. And my favorite what?
Dish.
Dish. Again, you know, I'll go back to, you know, people ask me, what is the greatest thing you can put in your mouth? I say, if I have the greatest bread that I can think of and the greatest butter, it's very difficult to beat bread and butter. So, but of course, there is more to that than cooking. But those are a really great dish, or a great tomato out of the garden with, you know, a great olive oil on top of it or something like that. Doesn't have to be complicated yet.
As Madeline says, while receiving chemo treatment last year, I found vicarious comfort watching you cook on TV every day during the week. Your personality was very relaxing. Thank you so much. You hear these kinds of comments. Nice to hear, I think.
That's very, very... You know, it's touching and it's nice. You know, thank you.
There's Lisa who says, back in the 90s, as a graphic designer in San Francisco, I worked with a photographer who also shot the images for Jacques Pepin's cookbooks. The photographer had a pet parrot who lived in the studio.
Oh, yes.
I was told that the parrot loved Mr. Pepin's cooking but would only eat it if he prepared it, rejecting food prepared by his assistants. I've always wondered if this was a true story.
Yes. I mean, sort of, yes. It was on 4th Street here, and it's her name escaped me. She was a great photographer. She was really terrific. And yes, the pet was there, and I used to feed him, because when I was an apprentice, which is 1949-1952, we had the same parrot in the kitchen, and I used to teach him some bad words in French. But cooking, he knew, he had a good nose too.
Yeah, obviously, I know you're cooking. Pepin is, listener writes, Pepin is such a breath of fresh air, breath of calm and civilized fresh air in the crazed new world of TV food shows. What does he think of the Iron Chef and all the manic contests and challenges? Has he ever watched them?
Not much, really, but I have watched some, and I think anything which brings people into food is great for me, without any question. I mean, the world of food now is so vibrant and so extraordinary in this country, and that's part of it. You know, we all do different things. I mean, you know, we're on television, people tend to confuse you with an actor. I mean, I'm not an actor. I'm not Dr. Kilder one season and someone else. This is who I am and the way I cook, and some people like me and some don't really care one way or the other, and some don't like me, but it's fine. There is nothing you can do. Julia always said that you have to be who you are. It makes your life much easier, and cooking, and certainly that's what we did when we cooked together, and we had a great time.
Listener named Eric says, I'm wondering if Jacques has any advice on the meta of putting together a recipe. For example, I walk into a market and there are a variety of items available and in season. With this blank page, it's easy to get lost with all the possibilities. Do you have any advice or an approach for how one can go about putting together a cohesive dish given the myriad of options available at any given time?
That's a good point, because I am faced with that conundrum, you know, often. But you have to minimalize, you know. I mean, the simplest, it is usually the best. And this is probably one of the mistakes of many young chefs, you know, putting a little bit of olive oil and a little bit of cilantro oil and a little bit of peanut oil and a bit of tarragon and then a touch of basil and a touch of this and a touch of that. And you have like 8 vegetables around your plate and you have something sliced, decorated in the center of it, and it may be good, but I go to dinner like this with other food editor who ask me, because being a chef, they suppose that I know what it is. I say, what do you think that is? I say, is it good? I say, yeah, it's pretty good. What is it? I don't know. Exactly. So, you know, if you can put something on your eyes and you're blinded and you sit down at the table and I'll give you a dish and that's chicken. There is mushroom in it. And I think deglaze with a bit of white wine, then you pretty far into the dish, and it's probably a very clean, neat dish. I mean, the type of food that I like to eat.
Let me go to more of your calls. Mike joining us from San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. First, like the other callers, I would like to thank you for just everything that you have done, and outside of my own father, you've probably been the biggest influence on me as a cook all these years.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Not your grandfather? Not grandfather. Just father.
No, my father.
Okay, thank you. Kidding.
My question is, you know, obviously the culinary world has exploded in the last, you know, 10 to 20 years, and I'm just curious what you feel are some of the more interesting, you know, new innovations and trends in the culinary world now.
I mean, certainly as we discussed a little bit before, you know, there is a new American cuisine which partake of many type of cuisine. And in that sense, the book that I have here is probably my most American book and purely American cuisine, because you can only do that in America. You know, in France, certainly there are Italian, there are, of course, and Chinese restaurant, but I mean, 99% of people, especially blue-collar worker, eat French, and the same thing in Italy, and the same thing in Switzerland or in Spain or whatever in Europe. But in America, it's quite different. I mean, you are a town like New York. There is 24,000 restaurants in New York, and the diversity of the cuisine, and the people who come from another country like me and can make it here, whether you're Greek or whether you're French or whether you're Italian, because it's America. And that the difference that you will have with this and Europe. And now, I don't think that I go back to France. I will be there next month. And I don't eat as well as I eat in America, I think.
Yeah, but, you know, I've always wondered how the French manage to stay so thin, given all the, not only sweet food, but all the breads that they eat and so forth. I mean, it's a remarkable metabolism almost, isn't it?
Well, you can eat it. You can swallow it, though. See, that's the point.
Is that the key to it?
Yeah, that's the key.
Have you read Michael Pollan?
Yes. And, yeah. I think it's great.
Yeah.
Terrific, yes, without any question. But, you know, time spent at the table is important. Not eating on the run, standing up, and the size of portion are much smaller. I mean, I remember when I came here, and then I worked for Howard Johnson, 1960 to 1970, for 10 years. I remember giving some soda, new soda, which were like 10, 12 ounces. I said, 12 ounces? Look at those. Soda and the portion. Now they are like 45 ounces. And the portion in the plate is just staggering.
So supersize me?
Yeah, right.
Caller Yvette, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Monsieur Pépin.
Oui, madame.
I am Belgian.
Mm-hmm.
And often I get the question, is Belgian cooking French cooking?
No.
And of course it is not. And I would I don't really know how well to answer to that, because, you know, I think it's very much French cooking in a lot of ways. What is your answer to that?
Well, yes, but the point is that if someone asks you, is Provençal cooking, the south of France, is Alsatian cooking? Alsatian cooking, the north, east part of France bordering Germany. No, of course, it's very different. Both are in France. There is probably more difference between the Provençal cooking of the south of France, of Provence, and Alsace than there is between Provence and Italy, or Alsace and Germany. So to a certain extent, Belgium has its own cooking. I mean, the rabbit with prune and the waterzooie and many, many dishes that you do and do very greatly, les moulets frites and so forth. I mean, you know, this is Belgium. So Belgium is just as different from the cooking of Paris and the cooking of Provence will be different from the cooking of Alsace, even though it is the same area of the world, you know, so...
There are some countries that seem to be almost deprived of national cuisine. I mean, I've always been stumped. My mother was from Canada. I've always been, mm-hmm. Is there a Canadian cuisine? If there is, I'm told there is, but...
Yes, well, certainly there is a French-Canadian cuisine.
French-Canadian, yes.
Very, otherwise, less. I mean, certainly, although it's quite vibrant, I don't think that I know any Chinese town as extraordinary as the one in Toronto. I mean, the food is amazing. And in Vancouver as well, too, but I like the way in Toronto better. So there is a great deal going, but otherwise, national cuisine, well, you know, maple syrup.
Yeah, bear food, somebody said. Asma is our next caller. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question about using wine in cooking. I grew up cooking Indian food. And now I'm starting to teach myself to cook other foods, but mm-hmm. wine is used a lot, and I can't use that ingredient. So I wanted to know what the best substitute is for red wine and what the best substitute is for white wine.
Well, there is many recipes that you don't have to use that. Remember also that if you have a specific problem, certainly, but otherwise if you use your wine properly and cook it, alcohol evaporate around, 185, 188 degrees in the form of vapor. If you happen to put a match, you'll see flambé. So if you don't put a match, it still evaporate. And to a certain extent, you don't really have, except a bit of residual sugar in it, you don't really have alcohol left in the dish that you cook for, you know, a stew with wine. But otherwise, if you can't, and if you don't want to, certainly you can always delay it with a bit of vinegar to get some of the acidity that you may get residually in the wine. And, you know, other type of juice, I mean, from apple juice to other type of things which will give a certain distinction to whatever dish you're cooking.
And we thank you for the call. And here's a listener who says, please ask Jacques about knives. How did he develop his amazing knife skills? Does he have any tips to increase proficiency and... how does he keep his knife sharp? Well, you've said that's the kind of knife you prefer. You
know? Yes. No, that's true. You know, and a knife is very, very important, you know, extension of your finger. And that's what I spend a lot of time in that DVD here, in that book, showing you the position of the hand and chopping and so forth. And my knife, even though I think my knife are sharp, they are never sharp enough for me. What happened is that if you look at the cutting edge of a knife, it's made of teeth, like any cutting instrument from a scalpel to a saw. And those teeth, when you bang the knife on the table, get out of whack. So you run them on what we call a steel, and you have to do it properly, and that realign the teeth, and they cut again for a while. But after a while, those teeth will be worn out. Then you have to send it out to someone who does lawnmower, or then you have to buy a big stone and spend 20, 25 minutes on it to create a new edge. And after that, you have a new edge. Again, you can use your steel for another 6 months or so. So, but most of the place that I go to, I look in the kitchen and people say, oh, my knife is really sharp. And I look, I say, well, which side, again, is sharp? So sharp is sharp. You know, if you have really an overripe tomato and just run your knife on top of it and it cut through, knife is probably sharp.
Tim joins us next. Tim, welcome.
Hi, thank you. What an honor to have you in the San Francisco Bay Area, Mr.
Thank you.
Cabin.
I'm delighted.
How wonderful. I wanted to pass something on to you really quickly. I lived with a remarkable couple in the Berkeley Hills when I was going to UC Berkeley, mm-hmm. and the lady of the house was French-Swiss by background, and her cooking style was mostly from Provence, and she barely spent an hour a day cooking, mm-hmm. and her meals were glorious. They were mm-hmm. beyond words. In fact, her son became a famous chef in the Pacific Northwest. I won't go into details. And my point is this. You know, you have this series, I think you call it Fast Food or something like that.
Yes, right. Yes.
Yeah. And Americans have this weird idea that you have to be chained to a stove mm-hmm. for 3 or 4 hours to make glorious and simple meals. And it's crazy. No. This woman, she worked all day at some doctor's office, and she would come home and start something and had a, you know, a this going and a that going and go to her garden. And then we would sit down like normal people at 8 o'clock and have a glass of wine and have incredible conversations. And I don't know, why does Americans think you have to become a slave to your kitchen to have beautiful meals that are nutritious and healthy for you?
It's true. I mean, the food that I did in fast food my way is exactly that type of food, and you should not be afraid to use the supermarket or the resources. But people are crazy. I mean, I'll go to a place where people want to make their own ketchup, want to make your own bread, and I've had bread which is like a piece of cement, and it's homemade, so you have to go on your knees because it's homemade. Who cares? You know, or ketchup. I mean, go get the best thing that you can get, and probably that's what that lady did. Get her best vegetable, get whatever she needed, you know, tiny baby vegetable, spinach, for example, then you don't have to clean them or two. And with good ingredient like that, a little bit of technique, great olive oil, butter, 200. I'm sure she did great dish in minutes. That's what my mother do. That's what most people who cook at home and work do, you know.
And we thank you for the call. David writes, what should a cook or chef keep in mind regarding the ambience of a restaurant or dining room? Is there a secret to creating a space that makes eating a food even more pleasurable?
It is. I mean, certainly for me, I go to a restaurant, you know, already the outside of the restaurant, the way how clean it is, flowers or whatever, you know, the way it welcomes you. You get in, you know, I can look at the feet of the table, if they are dirty or whatever. It probably tell me how the bathroom and all that will be toward the kitchen in the back. So already those first impression, the smell that you have, you know, and you're there already very hesitating, and then you ask the waiter or the waitress, what's good? They say everything is good. That's when you get up and run.
We had a woman on named Barb Stuckey who's written a book about taste, and she talked about how the sounds even make a difference in how you taste things. I mean, so ambience, you know, not only the sounds, but of course visually. It's all your senses, how things look in the restaurant.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the seat, you know, the chair, how comfortable, a large napkin for me, you know, which has not been tortured into a bird, which is just folded on the table next to my plate, large plate, the sound, the light on it. I like to see my food. You know, I go to those restaurants where I go into the kitchen and the chef is doing what I call a punctuation cooking, you know, a little comma, a dot, a semicolon with little bottle and all over the plate, you know. I call that punctuation cooking.
And no sentence fragments, no run-on sentences.
And then on an enormous plate, all that decoration, then they send it to the dining room. The dining room is so dark, you know, you have to have a flashlight to see what you're eating. There is nothing. So what's the point?
Let me go to San Rafael next. Lynn, you're on. Hi.
Did you say Lynn?
I said Lynn.
Oh, good.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I have so many questions, but the one that comes out, the most important, I'm really interested in teaching children how to cook and cook healthy food.
Right.
And any advice you have I would love it if you would write a book, but I think it's so important.
He's written 28, but not
what? On teaching children to cook.
No, but you have to involve the children from the beginning.
Exactly.
You know,
right.
I mean, when my daughter and my granddaughter was, 8, 10 months old, you know, a year old, I hold her in my arm to stir the pot. You know, I say, okay, allez, mélange. So she stir it and she quote, stir it, so she quote, made it. So she was going to test it anyway. So that's very important. The smell of the kitchen, as I say, after school, there is no place as comforting as the kitchen for a child, you know. The smell there, the noise of the kitchen, the noise of voice of his mother, father, that will stay with you the rest of your life. Then when you sit at the table, it should be fun, and there is no menu. I mean, it's not like we cook à la carte and the kid is going to have that and the parents are going to have this. I find it crazy of people who give other food. Even when Claudine was very small, whatever food we had, whether it pasta too, before I put too much seasoning in it, I put it in the food processor or the blender at the time and make puree out of it. And that's what she had. She got used to the taste of the pasta with garlic or whatever we were doing since she was very small. So that all of a sudden you have people who eat, the kids are eating pizza or are eating whatever boat food, and you're doing a roast of veal with some artichokes, and the kids are not accept to it. And all of a sudden, they turn 10 or 12 years old after their first communion or their bar mitzvah. And all of a sudden, they're adult. That now you have to eat like everybody else. The kids, what am I not eating that stuff? I never had it before. So it has to be gradual. It cannot be all of a sudden that the kid eat as an adult. It has to be from the beginning, from the moment you're born. You go to the garden with them. You show them the plant. You do. I do a little rabbit with an olive too. And then my daughter ate the olive when she was small because it was a little rabbit. You know, thing like that. You have to make it fun.
Have you read Proust?
Yes, of
because,
course.
Because, I mean, when you talk about food, yes, and how it imprints, yes, on your mind as a child and everything, it always makes me think of Proust.
Also, remembering of things past, you know, and there is that passage certainly in Proust, the little Madeleine, where he dunks his little Madeleine, which is a little coffee cake, in his tea in the afternoon, and all of a sudden he had that very strange sensation coming to his mind, which remind him of something, and he tried to analyze it, and he realized that it was in the country when he was a child. And then the taste of those little cakes that the maid, Rosalie, was doing to them. And by association of idea, the kitchen came back to it, and then the garden and that house, and as he said, the whole little town of Combray came out of his cup of tea. And certainly for us in the kitchen, you know, he talk about the memory of not the memory of the intellect there, but the memory of the senses. And those memory of the senses for a chef are extremely, extremely important. You know, those memory are the type of memory which assail you when you don't expect it. You walk in the wood. I'm there with my dog, and all of a sudden, I smell something. And I'm 10 years old, you know, when I was picking up mushroom or whatever.
Proust calls involuntary memory, in fact. You've just done such, yes, a wonderful synopsis of Proust, by the way, of remembrance of things past.
Thank you.
I want to read one last comment from someone named Dina, who says, I don't cook, and I almost changed the station when I heard you would be interviewing a chef, but I am so glad that I did not, because I am tearing up and enjoying listening to Mr. Pepin describe the thoughts, feelings, emotions, and memories evoked by one's favorite childhood foods. He is right. I would choose my Italian aunt's deviled eggs over dinner at any three-star restaurant. I don't cook, but he makes me want to try. I'm going to buy the DVD and see if it's not too late to learn something new.
Thank
I know
you.
That Mr. Pepin does not need another fan, but
thank
he has one.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Jacques,
thank
always
you.
Good to have you. Thank you so much.
Great
Jacques
to
Pepin.
Be here. Thank you so much.
The new book, Essential Pepin, it'll be airing, currently airing on KQED-TV. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.